From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Got a juicy story about a local politician? Want to right a wrong or set the record straight? Or how about just needing someone to tell a good news moment? Paul Raleigh is your man. His byline has graced the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune for 20 years as a columnist, local gadfly, and muckraker, and getting caught in Raleigh's crosshairs has been the downfall, or making, of many in this town. For 13 of those years, Raleigh had a partner in crime, Joanne Jacobson Wells, the point to his counterpoint. Today on the program, we're talking with both Raleigh and Wells about their collaboration, storytelling, and keeping power and influence in check. Plus, festival founder Fred Adams on the living language of Shakespeare. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Throw two seasoned, very different reporters into a partnership, and what do you get? Years of muckraking, rabble-rousing, and great storytelling. Paul Raleigh is celebrating 20 years as a columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune, and he and his longtime partner, Joanne Jacobson Wells, join us now to share memories and insight into the art of column writing. Paul Raleigh, of course, is a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, and he joins me in studio. And Paul, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Also with us, Joanne Jacobson Wells. She was Raleigh's co-columnist for 13 years, and she finished off her career as a teacher at Brighton High School. She now joins us by phone from her home in Murray. And Joanne, thanks for your time today.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
Later on in the program, how Shakespeare's language lives on. Utah Shakespearean Festival founder Fred Adams will join us. But first, Raleigh and Wells, have you ever sent in a tip or been stung in their column? Now's your chance to get even. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Paul Raleigh, I want to start with you. I think one of the things that people are drawn to in your column is that you really don't take yourself very seriously. You're willing to take it as you are to dish it out. Did you have to develop a thick skin, or does that just come naturally, not taking yourself seriously?
When I was in high school, I was a 90-pound weakling and got beat up every week, so I kind of developed a thick skin from there. You know, I mean, I've never taken myself seriously. I've seen people professionally in my profession and in other professions over the years who actually crash and burn because they take themselves so seriously. I've seen journalists who are no longer journalists because for some reason they got in their minds that they were the story rather than the story. And I've always, from day one, believed that it's the story, you know, and you're just there, you're just the messenger. And once you start thinking that you're bigger than that, it's time to quit.
Mm. You've been in the newspaper business your entire professional life. I understand you started at the Trib as a copy editor when you were still in college. What was that appeal, that initial appeal, the call to the newsroom?
Well, actually, it was a copy boy, which is the lowest rung you can get. Joanne was the obit writer, and so she got to boss me around because that's one rung above copy boy. But I was always, you know, I grew up in a house of people who loved to read the news and watch the news, and my parents took every news magazine available back in those days, and I really always loved current events. I always loved following them. That was one of my main interests as a child. And then I also realized that I, for some reason, because I really wasn't that good of a student in high school, but the one thing that always got me by is I had this knack of writing. I could write. And people told me that, so I decided to believe them. And those two things, I think, you know, attracted me to journalism and newspapers. And I was always fascinated with newspapers. I remember when, as a child, I'd go downtown and stay with my grandmother, who lived down on the Belvedere on State Street, and she took me over to see the presses run at the Tribune on Regent Street. So you know, I had an early fascination, and at, you know, probably by the time I was in college, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
I want to get to the genesis of the column, and I guess I want to hear your version, Paul, first, and then Joanne's. As the story goes, Salt Lake Tribune editor Jay Shellady took you aside, Paul Raleigh, and said, I want you to write a regular column. But he said he wanted you to find a partner, a co-columnist. So how did you team up with Joanne Jacobson-Wells?
Well, this when he came down to be our editor when Will Fair retired, I was the business editor at the time, and which was a good job at the Tribune, but I actually missed. Before that, I'd been a legislative reporter and a political reporter, and I missed that. That was really my first love. So I told him that I'd like to go back to that. And he told me that he'd been watching my byline over the years because he had been the publisher of our sister paper up in Idaho. He told me that he wanted to try something new. And I was the one who he wanted to try. I was his lab rat.
The guinea pig.
And so he told me he wanted me to do a column. And well, my first thought was, cool, you know, I'd be the David Broder of the Salt Lake, you know, Salt Lake City. What he had in mind, I didn't realize at first, was more of a combination of Herb Cain, Ann Landers, and Doonesbury. And then he started explaining that to me, and he wanted it to be an items column where I basically cover just about everything, and he wanted it to be diverse, do different things in the same column with different items. So I thought about that for a while. It took him quite a while to talk me into it, knowing this was a 2 or 3 month process.
So being a columnist wasn't a lifelong dream?
No, never. I never saw myself as a columnist. I saw myself as a hard news reporter, and that's what I loved. I started buying into the concept, and then he told me that I needed to have a partner, and so which I thought was weird because, these are little 3 or 4 paragraph items, and it's going to take 2 people to do it. Then he explained to me that he wanted it to be real edgy. He said, you know, what I have in mind for you, what you're going to do. And the reason he chose me, I think, is because it was well known in the newsroom. Over the years, after 20 years, I had a lot of sources in town. And he said that because it's going to be edgy and because we're going to be taking on the powers of the state and the city, and probably making them mad a lot, it needs to be balanced. He needs to have a balance of 2 people coming from different directions. In this state we're dominated by one religion. That was an issue for him. And so I'm not a LDS, and so my partner had to be LDS, active LDS.
Well, let's bring Joanne Jacobson-Wells into the conversation at this point. I understand you were a staff writer at the Deseret News at the time. So what was your first impression when Paul approached you with this idea of doing a 3-day-a-week column?
Paul and I had been friends for a long time, and I had started my career, as Paul mentioned, as an obituary writer at the Salt Lake Tribune. But I had left the Salt Lake Tribune and quit the Salt Lake Tribune to go on to other jobs, quit, come back, that I was living in Manhattan when I wanted to come back to Salt Lake. And I asked our editor, who was then Will Fair, my good friend, if I could come back to the Tribune. And he said no, he'd had enough of me quitting. And the Deseret News heard that I wanted to come back to Salt Lake, and they were very gracious and very wonderful and brought me back. So I, like Paul said, I worked at the Deseret News. So my home has always been the Salt Lake Tribune. And my closest friend at the Salt Lake Tribune was always Paul Raleigh. So I was, delighted. And I love the idea of being a columnist.
Had you guys written with other people before? Had you experienced what it's like to kind of tag team on in a writing assignment? Joanne first.
I've co-authored stories with other people before, but actually to sit in a cubicle and work with another person for 13 years, no, huh. I had not done that.
Paul, what was it like for you to transition from a reporter to a columnist, number one? So you're giving opinions on some level, and number two, writing with another person.
Well, Joanne and I had actually collaborated on some pretty ambitious projects and features years earlier when we were both reporters at the Tribune. So we'd co-authored series together before. It was difficult for me to make the transition. I have a hard news reporter's mentality. I still have a hard news reporter's mentality. I'd been trained, grew up with the idea of being balanced, balanced reporting, all those types of rules for journalists.
And all of a sudden, you're supposed to be edgy, huh?
And all of a sudden, I'm supposed to be edgy, and I'm supposed to be opinionated, and I'm supposed to be slanted. And so it was difficult for me to make that transition. Yep. And I think the column always was and still is kind of newsy, and that's what I bring to it. Joanne, was a very great news reporter as well, and so... although I think the column idea was a little easier for her because she has more of a personality than I do.
That's not true. I'm just a lot more opinionated and willing to vocalize that. Where Raleigh is a hard news person, and you're not supposed to give your opinion. And I think it's great. I think it's fun.
Joanne Jacobson-Wells is with us. She co-wrote a column for the Salt Lake Tribune for 13 years. Also with us, Paul Raleigh, the current columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, who's celebrating 20 years of column writing. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to get to a break in just a couple of minutes, but before we go there, I want to talk about not just the writing process, but the decision making. I mean, you have to produce 3 columns a week. I mean, that's huge volume. How are you finding the stories, and how did you guys fight amongst yourselves about what to write about? Because you only had a certain amount of room to do that. Paul Raleigh?
Well, I'm constantly on the phone, out searching around for ideas, for stories, for incidents, and I've never had trouble finding enough to write about, and I've also got a lot of sources in town, always have.
But did you and Joanne have disagreements?
Oh,
like,
sure.
Hey, this needs to go in the column this
Absolutely,
week.
Absolutely, because we do come, I mean, Joanne and I are best friends, but we also have different personalities, and we have different priorities, I think, in a lot of things. But and so we did fight about it, but it was healthy, and we compromised. Usually, when we'd make a decision, we'd always have quite a few things to choose from to put in the column, and then the things that could hold, we'd let those hold. The things that were the most timely would go in, and we always thought about having the column be a little different each day too. So if we had a bunch of little hard-hitting things one day, we'd have a priority maybe the next time to be a little lighter.
Mm. Joanne, can you talk about the decision making?
Sure. One of the it was timeliness. As Paul said, that's how we really decided. And the timeliness of an article. Some, we're breaking news. That's what Jay Shaliday wanted us to do. Our challenge was to print news that nobody else had. If it had been on TV or had been in the paper, we couldn't touch it. We had to have breaking news every day. So timeliness was a big thing. Also variety, because those little short pieces. So we tried to have politics, education. Whenever we could, we had to have variety. So it would appeal to all of our readers.
Mm. I want to get into some of the specifics in a little bit, but we do need to take a break. We're celebrating 20 years of column writing with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh. Also with us, Joanne Jacobson-Wells, his longtime collaborator. If you've been a source or unlucky enough to be skewered by Raleigh or Wells, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255 or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're marking a milestone in Utah journalism. Paul Raleigh has been a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune for the past 20 years. And today he joins us in studio, also with us by phone, his co-columnist for 13 of those years, Joanne Jacobson-Wells. And for years, he's dished out on everyone from politicians to the guy caught overwatering his lawn. So now it's your turn. What dirt do you have on Raleigh? And what's your favorite Raleigh column? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. So, have you guys ever been sued?
No, we've had our lives threatened.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We've been threatened with bodily harm, but we've never been sued.
Wow. That's kind of drastic.
Yeah, well, that's...
At the time it was.
Tell me the circumstances, Joanne.
The time that it happened to me is I just picked up the phone at my home, and the person said, "Is this Joanne Jacobson-Wells?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I'm going to kill you," and hung up.
So it wasn't related to any particular column.
I don't know. I didn't stay on the line that much, and I had two little children at the time, and they were sitting there, and I went, "Huh, that was weird." And then after they left, I called the Murray police and told them about it. But you know, stuff like that. Nobody ever tried to run us off the road or anything.
I think I'd prefer a lawsuit.
The call is enough.
Sure.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to retract something or to issue a heartfelt apology, Paul Raleigh?
Yeah, I don't know that we ever had to issue a heartfelt apology, but we have. We've done corrections, and it was always important that if we made a mistake and somebody pointed, you know, was able to show us that it was a mistake, to get that correction in the column. The Tribune has a corrections section where they put corrections, but we thought that it was always best to correct it right in our column and in the next column. So it hasn't happened very often. I mean, we've got a pretty good track record. And over the 20 years, we've done corrections on the column maybe 15 times, 20 times.
Mm.
So it doesn't happen very often. We're pretty careful.
The times that it has happened, though, I've and I'll remind Paul of his favorite one. He had gone home for the evening, and it was me who made the air, and I was watching the 5 o'clock news, and Dick Norris. It was a lead story on Channel 5. So people are pretty joyous when we did make a correction.
Of course.
And make an error, yeah.
Prior to the break, we talked about how you really didn't take yourselves very seriously. Paul, you continue not to. And I understand that you once registered your own church. Is that right?
Right, yeah. Well, I had been noticing that people, you know, and even a couple of politicians had registered as a church or a reverend or something, and I started looking into it and realized that was kind of an easy way to. That was kind of a scam, I thought, because you could become a church. It was very easy, and then you know you could take tax exemptions, and you buy a car and say it was property of the church.
It's a good deal.
Yeah, things like that, and so. We decided to point out how easy that was. So, I went down and registered my own church.
Called the?
It was the Church of the Holy Rolly. I was the left Reverend Paul. And Joanne was, she was my co-signer on the registration. It cost $25. Go down and pay $25 in your church. So we did that and then pointed and made fun of it in the column. We used to do some pretty crazy things.
I understand a state legislator once suggested that reporters should register as lobbyists, and so you did. Joanne, tell us about that.
Yes, we did. We registered as lobbyists, and the and our client was the public. We represented the public. We also showed how easy it was to register an offshore drilling, an offshore account. We were trying to make that just show people how totally easy that is. We registered. We got in a lot of trouble with some of the things we did. We heard that the Deseret News was going to change its name, and we heard the suggestions of what they were going to change it to, so we went down and registered all those.
Now, of course, you're famous for skewering politicians, and a favorite target was former Salt Lake City Mayor Dee Dee Corradini and some of her business practices when she was in the private sector. And this was a story that you guys broke, and it gained a lot of traction. I'm just wondering, when you have a news tip, do you ever have an inkling that something that you write is really going to blossom into an expose, a full-blown scandal? Or are you kind of surprised at what actually becomes news? Paul Raleigh?
No, I don't think we were ever surprised at what becomes news. We'd both been in the business for so long. We know what would gain traction and what would really hit hard. And that was part of the idea, was that, because Joanne and I were able to oftentimes find out about things before anybody else because of our network of sources. And when we brought Joanne in, it really expanded the network of sources because she and I had always covered different beats. And so we had sources from different areas, and she had a lot of sources as well. And the idea a lot of times was we would start it out and break it in the column, and then another reporter at the Tribune would take over, and if it was going to be a pretty big, heavy story that was going to have legs for a while, and then cover it from there. We were the ones who would break it, and then reporters would take over.
Hmm. It wasn't always the prominent people who were getting skewered. Again, you're very happy to point out the cop who leaves his car running during an inversion week, or the business that keeps its sprinklers on during the rainstorm. Joanne, everyone's accountable?
We had no sacred cows, and that meant that nobody was off limits. And that, you know, that was a very, very good policy to have. I wrote in our column that we had veto power over each other. At least Raleigh had veto power over me if he thought that I was writing about a friend, if I was too close to a friend. But we watched that very carefully, so no one was off limits.
Joanne Jacobson-Wells, former columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. Paul Raleigh, also with us, Salt Lake Tribune columnist for the past 20 years. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. In addition to pointing out some of the more boneheaded words and deeds that go on around here, you periodically highlight the unsung heroes and tout, you know, the good deeds that people are doing in this community that fall under the radar. How did that tradition of giving people their share of, you know, a pat on the back, how did that tradition start, Paul?
Well, Joanne and I always had that idea, and what we do, and then I've continued it, because people will call up and or they'll email us or they'll let us know about really great things that people do for each other, and sometimes we just put that, include that as part of the column with other things. And then we decided it would have more impact to save those because timeliness really wasn't that much of an issue on those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
And save those until we had enough to do a complete column of 7 or 8 or 9 of those kinds of deeds. And then we would do it that way. And I'm still doing it periodic. As soon as I get enough for a whole column, I run it. And I always love to do that because that's one of the, if not the most popular thing that we do.
It sounds like Joanne just got a call there. So we'll let her go ahead and turn to that. Do you have a favorite column?
Oh, you know what? I tell this story. My favorite column, and Joanne might have a different one, but my favorite column is a column that we never wrote. And I'll explain that. I'll try and make it short. It's kind of a long story. But there was a woman who was suing the Department of Transportation because her husband was killed on going up Parley's Canyon. And the reason he was – I won't get into all the details, but it was a result of negligence by the on the part of UDOT. They had paved the road over so many times that the medium that was supposed to push him back on the road – didn't work the way it was supposed to, and he got on top, his car skidded on top of it, and then he ran into a bridge abutment.
Mm.
She won the case and was awarded about $250,000. And I wrote about that. And then on appeal, the state prevailed because of government immunity. And so it was a technicality, and so they prevailed. And then her attorney called me up and said that now the Attorney General's office was going after her for attorney's fees because they prevailed, so they had the right to do that, even though it was a technicality and she'd actually won the case.
Mm.
So I called up the Attorney General's office and, you know, said, I understand you're going to go after attorney's fees for this widow who, you know, clearly it was found by a jury. Her husband was killed by negligence by the state. And they got together and talked for a while and decided that they didn't want to be in Raleigh and Wells with that, you know, going after a widow like that. So her attorney called me back a little while later and said, they've called us and said they're not going to go after attorney's fees.
Mm.
And that would have been about $40,000. So to me, I mean, that's the favorite thing to me that I've ever done as a columnist was save this widow $40,000. But once they decided not to do that, there was no column to write. So I always say that's my favorite one.
Mm. Yeah. One of the things that, you know, if you look at the columns that Raleigh has written, 3,122 columns. And what I think was one of the cutest things that somebody said to us is when they're in a business meeting, they make a decision and they say, if we make this decision, how will it play in Raleigh and Wells? And that has often changed decisions. And, you know, so I like to think that the column, I know Paul has played a real service to the public through this column.
Mm. Joanne, you wrote for 13 years and then decided to leave. How did you break the news to Paul, and how did he take it?
He took it great. We're close friends, The Tribune had a program where you could take early retirement and still keep your health insurance. And there were other things that I wanted to do before I really retired. And he was great. I mean, I was sad, and hopefully he was a little sad, but he didn't miss a beat. And we continued to be, you know, the best of friends, and the column continues to be edgy and wonderful, and so I don't. Yeah, sadly, I don't view it as a real loss to the column that I left.
Paul, what did it feel like going alone after 13 years? And did you ever consider getting another partner?
I wanted to tell this story because when it was scary at first because I'd gotten so comfortable, you know, with the Raleigh and Wells and us working together. So then I kind of thought, what am I going to do now? But there were several women, and it was women who at the Tribune who actually applied to be my partner and sent me emails and said, I want to be your partner, because everybody saw what a good time we had, and it's a fun job. I talked to my editor, and it was nothing against them. I mean, they're all great reporters and great people, but I said, you know, after Joanne, I can't have an, I, you know, nobody else will work. You know, I mean, Joanne and I think it was unique the way we fit together and work together, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that we'd been friends for, you know, 30 years, and I just said, I just can't see that. I can't have another part. I can't. She's irreplaceable, and so so we decided that I would, I'd go it alone, and I said I'd rather do it that way. So that's the way it came down.
Is it still fun after 20 years?
Oh, I'm having a blast. I've always loved it and still do. I don't know anybody who loves their job more than me. I'm still having a really good time.
Joanne, do you have any regrets about leaving?
No, I don't. And as I said in the last column that I wrote in Paul's tribute, I think it's a good policy not to look back with regrets, but forward to the next way that you can make a contribution to society. And so besides that, I'm going to be a grandma any minute.
That's what I've heard.
Any minute. And I'm sorry about that phone going off, but I'm going to be a grandmother, and that will take some time.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Our time is running out, but Joanne, finally, why do you think newspapers and communities need columnists in addition to journalists?
Let me think about this. Why they need columnists? First of all, I think they need newspapers to be a check for all the agencies. You know, anytime anybody says newspapers are dying, I just go, it's horrible. It's horrible. We need checks and balances, and the First Amendment is so important that I cannot believe that anybody would want to do away with newspapers. Columnists have a really big responsibility to be ethical and to really point out when public officials are doing wrong things. And I think that's the thing that Raleigh and I both felt very strongly about, is the ethics that we shared and just the demand we had to be totally accurate.
Yeah, sure. Paul, go right ahead.
I'd like to make a comment on that. Here's why I think columnists are important, because there's so much political spin that goes on, I'm a cynic, and I'm the first to admit that because of what I've seen over the years, and you see so much political spin. And everybody's got, you know, most politicians have their own PR people to, you know, give you a spin on certain thing. Journalists are trained to be balanced and get both sides. The problem is with that, I mean, and that's a good rule, for news reporters. But the problem with that is sometimes one of the sides doesn't tell you the truth. And when you're a columnist and you're not bound by that rule so much, where you can look at it and then make your own conclusion about what's right and what's wrong with this story, then you can say it. And I think that that's important. I think, and we've done that many, many times in the Raleigh and Wells column, and I'm proud of that. And we've gotten, people call up and say, you know, that was one-sided. But, we're very, you know, careful and very serious about examining which is the best way to go or the angle to go with a certain column item. And I think that that's a great role. That's why you need columnists, because sometimes they can cut through the spin and cut through the spin and really tell what the story is really all about.
You're still having fun. You argue for the central role that columnists play in democracy. It doesn't sound like you're going anywhere.
I'm going to be around a while. I'm getting older, and
aren't we all?
You know, and there at a certain point, I want to realize my lifelong fantasy of hitting the road in a camper van with my wife and discovering America. But I'm going to be around for a while longer.
Paul Raleigh, a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, celebrating 20 years of column writing. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
And congratulations. Joanne Jacobson-Wells, a co-columnist for 13 years, just retired as a teacher and an expectant grandmother. Joanne, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Up next, it's Fred Adams and the language and the value of Shakespeare in contemporary life. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. To be or not to be, what's in a name? Parting is such sweet sorrow. These are some of the most recognizable and meaningful phrases in the English language, and they come from the beloved poet and playwright William Shakespeare. Why do the words of someone who wrote 400 years ago continue to resonate with us today? Joining us now to parse Shakespearean verse is Fred Adams. He is founder and executive producer emeritus of the Utah Shakespeare Festival, and he's joining us by phone from Cedar City. And glad to make the connection, Fred. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here. There.
Do you find yourself saying all the world's a stage? How do Shakespeare's words continue to affect your conversation? If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Fred Adams, of course, Shakespeare is considered the greatest writer of the English language. As a young scholar, what got you so hooked on Shakespeare?
I think as a youngster, seeing him performed was the catalyst for me. It was saying something so beautifully and so spot on that I kept thinking, "Wow, you know, I wish I could express myself like that." I think that's what first challenged me. And then I had parents who were both in the theater for a portion of their lives. So they kind of instilled in me a love for language, and it kind of rubbed off.
Well, what is it about these words, these phrases that we're all so familiar with? What about them speaks to us today?
Well, I think number one, of course, is the discipline with which he wrote, because it makes what he says sound so much more beautiful than we could say it. For example, Romeo describes a sunrise to Juliet on the morning after their wedding night, and he says, "Look, love, what envious streaks do lace the severing clouds in yonder east. Night's candles are burnt out, and jocund day stands tiptoe on a mountaintop." And I think, wow, you know, all I could ever say was, "Oh, look, the sun's coming up."
Sure.
And it loses something in that translation. I don't think that anyone aspires to speak everyday language, but we do speak Shakespeare every day. Just common, ordinary phrases, hundreds and hundreds of them, that never, ever appeared in print until in one of his plays. It's all Greek to me.
Fred Adams, founder and executive producer emeritus of the Utah Shakespeare Festival, and Dr.
Yep.
Adams will be talking about Shakespearean theater and the Bard's use of the English language and how it continues to shape conversation and perspective today, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock here at the Main City Library. We'll put up more information on our website, kcpw.org. Fred Adams, so... how exactly are we seeing Shakespeare's legacy in conversation, in contemporary writing and playwriting?
Oh yes. Well, of course, playwrights have been inspired by him, as have poets. But let me just ask the listeners, have any of you ever said playing fast and loose? Have you ever used the term tongue-tied, a tower of strength? Have you ever made virtue of a necessity? Have you ever insisted on fair play or too much of a good thing or cold comfort? All these are phrases that Shakespeare originated. If he did not originate them, he's the first one to have written them. In other words, nothing appears in print any place prior to that phrase or each of those phrases appearing in one of Shakespeare's plays. And well, we use those every day, everyday expressions, constantly. A fool's paradise, be that as it may, have you seen better days? Our language is just filled with expressions of Shakespeare. And it goes even further than that. I would venture a guess that a sizable percentage of words that we call English, the English language today, were literally originated by him. Or if not originated, he first wrote them down. In other words, he heard them on the street, or he heard them in a tavern, and wrote words down that today are just everyday words for us. So, yeah, he really is the architect of our language.
It has been 400 years, though, since he wrote many of these phrases that are now so commonplace. Why hasn't another Shakespeare come along? Or has anyone even come close to infusing meaning into our language like Shakespeare did?
No, that's a rough one. Because even during his lifetime, he lived surrounded by playwrights that made... Oh, and had they lived in any other time frame, would have been the greatest playwright of that era. It just seemed like heaven unzipped itself and just poured out all these great writers, these great wordsmiths, almost all at the same time. In England, it was easy to understand because it's a language that was just starting. So language was brand new and fresh and being made up fresh every day. But almost contemporary with him are the greatest playwrights of Spain, the greatest playwrights of France, the greatest playwrights of Germany. And you think, wait a minute, you know, what was going on at this time that all of a sudden all of this writing just flooded what was then known as the civilized world?
Clearly, this would be conjecture on your part, so maybe my question is a little unfair, but do you think Shakespeare had any idea of how his words would continue to live on, to resonate on both page and on stage, and in the lives of people for hundreds of years beyond his lifetime?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he even comprehended that his plays would outlast him. His plays were an ephemeral thing. They were light as air. They were an entertainment, and entertainments were not of any importance. But all of a sudden, one day, he's walking down the streets of London, and a young boy comes up selling paperbacks. What we would today consider a paperback. It was known as a quarto, but it was a cheap printing of dramas. And there was his play, Midsummer Night's Dream. That he hadn't done. He'd written it, but someone had taken it down in shorthand and printed it. And it just astounded him because, number one, it was done so badly, and number two, so much of what he wrote wasn't even in it or had been bastardized, that he then turned to some of his compatriots and said, "Look, here are my manuscripts. Put my plays in print. If they're going to be remembered, I want mine to be remembered. I don't want some doggerel under my name to be published." But I think it came as a surprise even to William Shakespeare that anyone would ever consider preserving a play and continuing to do it.
I only got about a minute left. Fred Adams, you founded the Utah Shakespeare Festival, yes, which has been growing and going strong for 50 years now. You're now in your 80s. How are you reading Shakespeare differently now than you did, say, 30 years ago? Has the meaning changed for you in any way?
Oh, drastically. And it changes almost every year. But as I get older, I have a great example. When I was in high school, I read King Lear, and I thought, this is a play about a very foolish old man. Then I get into college, and I have to study Lear, and I realize this is a play of a confused man who needed guidance. Then I become a father, and I look on Lear, and I say, oh, wow, this is a father that loved his children too much. And now I'm a grandfather. I'm Lear's age. And I'm saying, you know, this is a tremendous giant of a gentleman who was put upon by evil forces. And my attitude of the man has totally changed as I've gotten closer to his age.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't think you ever comprehend and grasp all of what William Shakespeare is saying. But the challenge and the fun, the adventure, is in discovering what you can.
Fred Adams, founder and executive producer emeritus of the Utah Shakespeare Festival. Sir, I'm sorry our time is up. We'll have to have you on the program again.
I loved you. Thanks, Jennifer. So fun to talk with you.
Dr. Adams, we'll be talking about Shakespearean theater and how the Bard's use of the English language continues to influence us today. The evening will also feature music and dance, and you can find more information about the event tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the City Library on our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Next time, the music and talent of Grammy-nominated performer Kurt Bester. So join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.